From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Did U.S. intelligence services illegally spy on private American citizens who happen to be part of the Trump transition team? This is talk show host Tucker Carlson asking the question.
General Michael Flynn, we hardly knew ye. The National Security Advisor is gone after less than a month in the White House. He was brought down after his conversation with Russia's ambassador to the United States was wiretapped by U.S. intelligence, despite protections that are supposed to block such wiretapping of U.S. citizens. Perhaps Flynn deserved to go for apparently lying to the vice president, but even if he did, what does it say about U.S. intelligence that it may be spying on the administration?
Trump himself appeared to be raising the same question in a tweet that was issued on Wednesday, suggesting also that the U.S. intelligence community may be illegally leaking sensitive information to hurt the administration. It's widely recognized that many of the attacks on Trump are in response to his announced intention to change the orientation of U.S. foreign policy. We discuss that and more, particularly with implications for the Latin America Caribbean region, with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Okay, Tony, welcome back. Let's take a look at what's happening in the region.
Okay, yeah, Don, and the big event over the next few days is going to be the national presidential election and legislative elections as well in Ecuador.
Right.
The first round will be in Ecuador. On the 19th in Ecuador, Sunday the 19th, this Sunday.
Right.
So there, Ecuador has a system whereby the various candidates contest the first round, and then the first two people that win that, that come first and second in that, in the first round of the voting, then go on to a second round, usually about a month later. Mm. And for somebody to win outright, they'd have to get over, I think it's over 45 or 50% of the vote.
Right.
And it's unlikely that that's going to happen. And I think we had a quick look at the candidates for this election in Ecuador a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, we did.
But just to give a quick summary, the leading candidate, the one who's heading the opinion polls, but not with a very high majority. It's only the last opinion poll only gave him 28%. And I don't know what the orientation of that polling company was, but it looks as though that it's very clear that he's not going to win on the first round, and that's Lenin Moreno, who's the candidate of Rafael Correa's government coalition, and he's in first place at the moment, and then he's followed by two right-wing politicians, Gabriela Vitieri and a guy, I think it's Guillermo Lasso, and the runoff is likely to be between Lenin Moreno and Lasso, or it's possible that Vitieri might pull a surprise, but unlikely. So and that's what's likely to happen on Sunday, once the count is in, and then it'll go to a second round, as I say, about a month further on.
And our listeners should just be reminded that there will, in any event, there'll be a change of presidents. That Rafael Correa is not standing this time, and so he'll be finishing his term up.
Yeah, that's why Lenin Moreno is the candidate, because Rafael Correa has decided not to run again. Much to many people's disappointment, because if he were to run, he'd probably win easily on the first round. Anyway, and so the chances are that Lenin Moreno will do well enough on this first round to easily win, and then it's a question of whether he can mobilize sufficient votes from the people who don't want to vote for a right-wing candidate to win on the second round. And there he has the difficulty that, as happened in Argentina, in the Argentinian election, there's a kind of 5-7% vote for a more radical left-wing policies that may or may not vote for Lenin Moreno. And so I'm quite nervous actually about whether Lenin Moreno will be able to mobilize enough support to win clearly on the second round. I think that he will, but it's by no means a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
And that's very important in the region, because as we mentioned the last time we spoke about these elections, and in this, Ecuador is a member of ALBA, the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas that was founded by Fidel Castro and Comandante Hugo Chavez. ALBA is made up of Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Antigua and Barbuda. I think it's Saint Kitts. I've forgotten the names of all the Caribbean island nations. Dominica. I think it's a total of four of the Caribbean island nations that are members of ALBA. The important thing is that ALBA has been the driving force for the agenda of progressive regional integration, solidarity-based integration, integration based on complementarity in trade and economic exchange,
right.
With a strong component of development cooperation. Between all the countries that make up ALBA, and those countries for most of the first 15 years of the current century, say between 2006 and say 2013, something like 2014, the ALBA countries were quite strongly supported by Brazil and Argentina. And that's not the case now, following the coup, the soft coup against Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, and the election largely under false pretenses of Mauricio Macri in Argentina.
Right.
And people in Argentina are now paying the price for their misguided vote for Mauricio Macri, because the policies there for most people in Argentina strongly disapprove of Mauricio Macri now, and Macri himself is involved in at least four corruption scandals. Of course, in Argentina, they're trying to distract attention away from that by trying to focus on non-existent corruption by former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, as they're doing in Brazil. And the right-wing government in Brazil under, is it, I've forgotten the name, President Temer. And Temer and his colleagues are up to their eyes in corruption, but they're trying to divert the attention on their wrongdoing onto former President Ignacio Lula da Silva.
Right.
So that's, and what that means is that that all that context makes this election in Ecuador very, very important, because if the right wing can win Ecuador, then they'll be in a much stronger position to completely roll back the strong progressive agenda of regional integration that have been pushed by Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador in South America, and very much by the Sandinista government here in Nicaragua. And so, let's hope that Lenin Moreno does well in this first round and is able to mobilize sufficient support to win on the second round.
Yeah.
So,
I'm hoping that people have learned the lesson. You know, I'm hoping people in Ecuador have learned the lesson of Argentina and Venezuela in terms of their voting.
Yeah, and I think, and that's very much a factor in favor of Lenin Moreno and his electoral coalition, and there of course the right wing are doing exactly the same as their right wing counterparts in Argentina and Brazil. They're trying to cook up phony allegations of corruption against Lenin Moreno. In this case, they can't go after Moreno because Moreno's squeaky clean himself. But they're trying to go after his vice presidential candidate, Jorge Glass, and that, but so far without success. So I think that the voters in Ecuador are sufficiently sophisticated to have taken note of what's happened in Argentina and of what's happened in Brazil. And my feeling is that Lenin Moreno will do well enough in the second round to win the presidency and keep Ecuador within the progressive camp of governments with progressive and radical policies in South America.
You know, let me ask you a question. Are you familiar at all with the media landscape there? Is it like Argentina and Brazil, where it's almost all, you know, corporate?
It's very similar. The media, the difference there is that about four years ago, the government passed some media legislation, making it much more difficult for the corporate right-wing media there to concentrate their attacks on the government, and it was a legislation that insisted on some, I can't remember the exact provisions of the legislation, but essentially what that legislation did was it created a framework that made it much more difficult for right-wing media to carry out the kind of propaganda attack that the right-wing media in Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina have been able to carry out over the last couple of years.
Yeah, they call it the Ecuadorian Communication Law, or the Organic Communication Law. That's what they passed in 2013.
Yeah, okay. So that is one very big difference between this election campaign in Ecuador and the election campaigns that have taken place in Argentina, the ongoing crisis in Venezuela, and the continuing crisis in Brazil, where the corporate media have been essentially fulfilling the role of the political opposition. And Rafael Correa himself has explicitly said that. Yep. That in Latin America, and specifically in South America, the corporate media fulfill the role of the political opposition that the traditional political parties are unable to fill because of their complete absence of policy proposals that are attractive to the electorate. Okay. And so Rafael Correa's argument, with which, I mean, anyone observing the scene from a progressive, in the region, from a progressive point of view, would very much agree with Correa. The role of the corporate media has been to fill the policy vacuum of the traditional right-wing political parties with vicious attacks on progressive governments. Yep. And that's what makes that's another thing that makes the electoral campaign in Ecuador so interesting to observe, because it's actually a much more level playing field, if one has to use that metaphor, than the election, for example, in Argentina in 2015.
Right. You know, it's interesting because the law that Correa ended up getting passed requires the private broadcasters to give up a third of their broadcast time for public broadcasting. So, in other words, you know, what you would call here a taking by eminent domain of this private resource, that where there's a severe public interest in it, and essentially a democratizing of a third of the media.
Yeah, and of course the right wing argument against that is that it's dictatorship.
Right. I should be able to scream at the top of my lungs.
Free speech. Wow. Those kinds of arguments.
Right. Yeah. There's some. But in essence, they're saying, I demand the right to be able to scream at the top of my lungs, and you know, not allow anyone else to speak. That's the right they're demanding.
Yeah, and it's monopoly capitalism, isn't it? And exactly it's right. Just applied to the communications media. Right. So let's see how things pan out in Ecuador, and the taking that theme of the media and the way the media dominate and shape perceptions and permitted discourse and the kinds of arguments that people are even able to make, and one of the things that's happened recently that's very interesting from my point of view in terms of whether or not under President Trump, United States foreign policy in the region is going to be very different to the policy applied by President Obama. The Trump administration has now made this accusation against the vice president, is it Tariq Al-Assami, in Venezuela, and they're accusing him of being involved in the drugs trade.
Right.
And, you know, it's Tariq Al-Assami. He was recently named vice president by President Nicolas Maduro, and he's been accused by the United States authorities of being involved in drugs trafficking. And that's very similar to what the United States authorities did in the case of Diosdado Cabello, when Diosdado Cabello was president of the National Assembly. They accused him of being involved in drugs trafficking,
which turned out to be a fabrication.
And what that comes down to is it's a complete poisoning of the of diplomatic relations between the two countries, because these accusations are completely false, flagrantly false. But they maintain an image for the domestic North American audience, and also for the media audience in Latin America, that there's somehow some kind of relationship between the Venezuelan government and organized crime, when in fact the reverse is true.
Right,
Venezuela's opposition and the regional right wing, for example, the right wing under former Colombian president Alvaro Uribe in Colombia. It's the right wing in Latin America that are deeply implicated in organized crime and corruption. But what the United States government is doing is kind of setting an agenda which the corporate media in North America and Latin America then consolidates. And that agenda is to demonize and treat as criminals leading members of progressive governments in the region.
Yep, and it's worked. You know, it's an interesting conundrum looking at the relationship that will develop, or that's been developing thus far, between the new administration and that region. And it's funny that you mentioned the media as functioning as the opposition party in Latin America, when that's exactly the accusation that was leveled by Trump's administration against the media in the United States. You could argue with seriously good cause. And it places pressure on him against doing things like, resetting relations with Venezuela. You know, he comes into office with this finding by the former president of the United States, Obama, that Venezuela constitutes a threat to the U.S. national security, which is absurd on its face, and forgetting their intent. They don't have the wherewithal to do it. And so we're looking at things like what happened yesterday, where suddenly Sean Spicer, Trump's spokesperson, is talking about Russia should give back Crimea. It definitely flies in the face of the tone he set in his campaign, and it's clearly the result of domestic pressure from the media.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating looking at the United States from the outside and seeing how the entrenched interests, the entrenched corporate interests, the entrenched media interests, and the entrenched political interests are using against their own people the very same policies that they've used to oppress people overseas. And you've got the satanization, the demonization of a political leader, in this case Donald Trump. You've got the massive media campaign completely distorting the reality of the policies that Trump is proposing, and For example, the immigration policies, Trump's immigration policies, are largely extensions of measures brought in by President Obama.
Right, that's it. He didn't even have to name five of the seven countries on the list, but merely reference an existing statute and findings of the government that were in place when he took office.
Yeah, and it's fascinating for us outside the United States to watch the same thing happened in the election campaign, and the established powers were stunned by the fact that they were unable to prevent the people they got used to repressing. From voting for Trump, and so it's like they just assumed that the population that they'd always kept under their thumb for decades would once again vote as they were told to vote,
right.
And they didn't,
right.
and that seems to me to be a very close parallel with, you know. Why is the U.S. government and the U.S. authorities, why are they attacking Venezuela? Because the Venezuelan people haven't voted the way they should have voted from the point of view of the U.S. authorities and the U.S. corporate elite. Why have they mounted this campaign against Ignacio Lula da Silva and Dilma Rousseff in Brazil?
Right.
Because the Brazilian people voted those politicians into office, and that was not to the liking of the corporate elite in the United States and Western Europe.
Right, that's right.
And it seems to me there are very close parallels between the behavior of the entrenched elites in the United States towards their own people and towards Donald Trump, and the behavior of those entrenched elites towards peoples in Latin America and elsewhere, of course, who don't vote the way the elites like, and then subsequently against the leaders, the progressive leaders, that come to power on the strength of that popular vote.
Well, Malcolm X reminded us that chickens always come home to roost.
Right, right, yeah. For what it's worth, I know I've been arguing for several years now that what is happening in North America and Western Europe is that as the corporate elites in the West find that it's harder and harder to get as much money as they used to from the majority world, because countries like China and Russia are providing competition that the corporate elites can't match.
Right.
As that process advances, they're applying against their own peoples the same kind of structural adjustment policies, the same kind of wealth extraction policies. They're applying those same wealth extraction policies against their own people that they can no longer apply so easily overseas.
Yeah, to like
and
half
that seems
the population.
To be absolutely clear.
Yeah, I mean, like half the population of the planet is out of their reach now, almost, you know, and so they need to double down on the other half, and it's finally come home to roost.
That's why, for the last 30 years or so, wages in the United States have stagnated. Then, in order to compensate for that, the corporate financial elites enabled a system of easy credit, mostly under Alan Greenspan. And then when that blew up in 2008, they're now faced with a very difficult reality to which the vote for Trump was a response from the people who suffered most as a result of the previous misguided policies. And you know, what's going to happen now?
You had that easy credit had a double effect, because what they were doing essentially was metabolizing the accumulated wealth of the working class and a large chunk of the middle class, because as their incomes went down, they basically took the equity out of their homes and whatever other things they owned by pledging them as collateral for loans that ultimately they defaulted on. And they not only have seen stagnant wages, but there's been a large net loss of their accumulated wealth.
Well, a massive transfer to the corporate elites.
Right. So then you have hand in glove with the imposition of these economic conditions on people, bringing home the repressive apparatus that they've exercised all over the world elsewhere.
Yeah, and the kind of corollary of that, if you like, in Latin America is that because people in Latin America reject those policies, you then find that in Venezuela's case, the opposition, because they haven't been able, except in the legislative elections, to get the political power that they need to impose their agenda, and they can, and right now they can see that there's every chance that they've let their opportunity slip, and that Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues in the Socialist Party of Venezuela will actually make a comeback and be able to roll back the gains, the electoral gains that the right wing have made in Venezuela. That's why the right wing in Venezuela are trying to continue to destabilize the government through with every kind of strategy, economic sabotage, literal sabotage of electricity generation, hoarding of goods in order to artificially inflate prices for basic commodities, and that they're unable to win by conventional political means, so they're using every other kind of means in order to get what they want, and that's why the election in Ecuador is so important, because it is a real political test of whether people in a quite sophisticated electorate are going to be suckered again, as people were in Argentina, by this phony right-wing agenda that has nothing to offer people.
And a left split, also, like we saw, you know, with the ultra-left or whatever, either sitting out the election in Argentina or, you know, splitting, you know, that. Let me, because we're running out of time, I want to get to this point, right, too. In Venezuela, for example, you see the value of having the military stay, you know, out of politics or support the government. You know, that is, of course, not the case in a number of the other countries where they openly side with the right and pressure with the right. Here in the United States, this is being raised, as, you know, basically as a threat. Foreign Policy magazine's article talking about three ways to remove Trump from office before 2020 actually had four items, and the last one was a military coup or refuseniks among the military.
Yeah, and here in Latin America, the chances of a military coup in Venezuela are zero, really. Likewise, in Argentina, and the armed forces there, and although they're still kind of right wing, and certainly the military leadership in Argentina tend to be right wing, but they do seem to have reformed in terms of their willingness to involve themselves directly in politics, and so it's extremely unlikely that there'd be any kind of military solution to potential popular unrest in Argentina, and I think the same is true in Brazil, I think the armed forces in Latin America are very, very different from the armed forces that prevailed when they were directly trained by the United States at the torture school up there in Fort Benning, that was called the School of the Americas back then. And those days are gone, and let's hope for good.
You know, and on that point also, I'm wondering if, you know, the taking out of the National Security Advisor to Trump isn't an attempt to essentially cover that particular base in the event that they need to activate it, where, in other words, having a general as your closest advisor who has strong institutional support in the military, they just took him out.
Right, well, okay, thanks a million, Don. Good to talk to you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.